On the Philosopher's Zone, getting good returns from your goodwill.
I think history has taught us that going out there with huge ideas that don't react to the complexity of the real world is doomed to failure. I think the more sensible approach is getting everybody just thinking a little bit more carefully about who they're trying to help, because I think most people do want to make the world a better place, and how they're going about offering that help.
It's the season of good intentions. Many give to charities, hoping to help those less well off. Simple acts of kindness, but do they work? Well, there's a new turbocharged utilitarianism about that has little time for random deeds. Quite the contrary, better to be calculated, targeted, and maximally efficient. It's called effective altruism, and it seems to have its share of youthful philosophers behind it, like Sebastian Farquhar, who wrote the movement's defining statement. Sebastian Farquhar, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, I believe you wrote the first ever statement on effective altruism. I imagine that that's both scary and an honour. How did you approach that task? I mean, even coming up with the term effective altruism must have been an interesting game.
To be entirely blunt, when we came up with the term and when I wrote that statement, I hadn't the foggiest idea, and I don't think anybody did, that it would take off as a concept at all. So at the time we were working on Giving What We Can, which is sort of a community for people who want to give effectively, and 80,000 Hours. And we wanted a term that sort of described philosophically what our motivations were. The intention wasn't at all to create any sort of movement or community around the idea, but it appears to be that the idea resonates well, that it really gets at something that is going on in the modern age, that people care more about doing good, but they also care more about doing good effectively. More than I would have expected, it really latched on to the popular imagination.
Hmm. What does it mean to be doing good in an effective way?
It means different things to different people, and that's only natural. In general, when we approach the question of making a difference in the world, which I think really most people, almost all of your listeners, will want to make a difference in the world and make the world a better place, it's about trying to work out using evidence or analysis your best guess as to what's going to achieve those objectives as effectively as possible. So given that we only have a certain amount of money that each of us is able to give to charity, or a certain amount of time that we're able to put into making the world a better place, how do we get the most bang for our buck?
And you've actually worked out an algorithm with a particular measure, quality-adjusted life years. Tell me about this measure and algorithm and how it works.
So the QALY is sort of traditionally how the health economics community thinks about doing good in the world in a quantitative way. And I should say this is only one factor that one might look at when one's trying to do good and is a great tool in health. But obviously there are other things that we care about which one can't capture in that idea, like educational outcomes or any number of other things. The quality adjusted life year is a tool where you set sort of equal to one what a perfectly healthy year for a person would be like. And then for various conditions, health conditions that people might have, you use a lower number, somewhere between zero, which would represent being dead, and one, which is perfect health, to represent how good that year is for the person living that year. And this is a tool which has been around for something like half a century now, and in many countries is used by either the National Health Service here in the UK or by health economists to work out how effective different types of treatments are. So some treatments might be able to buy you a full QALY, so a full healthy year of life, for $100. And another might require $100,000 to get that same healthy year of life. But of course, that one QALY could be 5 years of slightly improved life rather than 1 year of extra life extension.
I just wonder for you and for effective altruism, whether it's the maximum number or maximum efficiency that's important here, because there are two concepts butting up against one another. How do you trade those off?
So there's a interesting empirical feature of the world, which is that it's enormously more cost-effective to increase the quality of life of people who have relatively little. And so one of the things that almost just it pops out of the numbers is that when you're going about trying to make the world a better place, it's almost always right to start with those who are worst off. And so let me give you an example of that. Purely because resources are so scarce in large parts of the developing world, there are opportunities to do health interventions there which cost something like $5,000 Australian for one quality adjusted life year. If you look at how the UK allocates its resources in the National Health Service, we're willing to spend about £30,000, which I think translates to something like $60,000 Australian, although I'm not certain about that.
Close enough.
Close enough. At any rate, this tension between getting to the maximum happiness for the maximum number of people and more redistributive or justice-based approaches often just doesn't emerge in practice because of this feature of the world where it's so much more cost-effective to help those who are badly off. So I think that there's an instinctive and a very understandable pull towards things that are close to you, people that you know, that you interact with on an everyday basis. And I think it's right that we feel a strong desire to either help those who are close to us or to support the communities that helped us develop. But despite that, I think it's important for us to put at least some of our attention to working out where our resources can do the most good, setting that part of our connections aside, because, you know, everybody is somebody's son or daughter, and everybody has those sorts of connections. And to a very large extent, it's pure chance that some of us are in very wealthy nations and some of us are very badly off. So Peter Singer uses the example of the drowning child. Picture, he says, a child who's drowning in a pond right in front of you, and you could wade in and save the child, but it would ruin your nice shoes. I don't know, maybe they cost $200. It would be unconscionable not to go in, not to save that child. But we're basically in this situation on a daily basis because there is in the world great suffering. And there are people who are dying or suffering from very easily preventable conditions. And it doesn't seem like there's any principled moral difference between the child who's right in front of you and the child who's far away, purely in terms of the distance.
Having said that, though, one major difference is that the child in front of you is in front of you and calls to a common humanity in a way that perhaps those further away from you don't command that same level of interaction at that time. I mean, is that part of the problem with that particular thesis?
So we can separate two different ideas here. One is whether there's in fact a different emotional or behavioral response. And this is sort of a question about human psychology. And of course there is, of course there is. But then there's another question about whether there ought to be, whether the immediacy of a thing ought to exert a different kind of moral pull on our activities. And I think the world probably is a better place if people behave with a certain set of responsibilities towards those near to them, partly just because we understand the condition of those near to us much better. And so I think it's right that we behave in this sort of more deontological way. We do leap to save the drowning child and are maybe a little bit more hesitant to save those that are abroad. But I think there needs to be a balance between those two things. Because while it's easy for us to know what's right to do in the case of the child, if we put in a little bit of effort, we can work out what's right to do in the case of those that are quite far away. And as the almost the science of development is improving, we have much better access to good, high-quality evidence about what actually helps people in developing countries and how cost-effective it is for us in richer parts of the world to provide tools or resources that allow people in developing countries to improve their condition.
Hmm. So more on the theory of effective altruism, another thing that you say is that one should think counterfactually. What does that mean and how does that work?
So this is a very powerful notion, which is absolutely fundamental to science, which is that when you try to work out what the impact of your action is, you need to think about what would have happened if you hadn't acted. An example of this, which I think really brings out quite starkly the underlying ideas, is if we imagine that you're walking down the street and you see somebody who has collapsed and you're in a position to run over and give them CPR. Now, you're not very good at CPR. Well, I'm not very good at CPR. I don't know about you. You may be very highly trained. But if I go over, maybe I'll be able to save their life, but cause them some injury in the process. Now, if it's just me and them, and there's nobody else around, obviously I should run over and I should administer CPR. And I'll injure them, but I'll save their lives. Now, if on the other hand, there's a highly trained paramedic right next door, and I were to run over and administer CPR despite the fact that there's a highly trained paramedic, I'd be doing harm, even though I'd be directly responsible for saving the person's life, because the difference between what happens if I act and what would have happened otherwise is just that the person is injured, because if I hadn't acted, they would have been helped by this highly trained paramedic. So this applies to a lot of features in, for example, what you want to do with your careers. So a lot of people think that it's really desirable to go and work for a nonprofit or a development charity. But often positions at development charities are very competitive and lots of very, very talented people want to do them. So if you didn't go and do it, somebody else, maybe not quite as good as you, would have gone and done it otherwise. You're still making a difference, but relative to what would have happened otherwise, you're making a smaller difference than you'd first guess.
This has made quite a splash because there's this idea that you might as well be working in the finance industry, make a lot of money, and then donate it to an efficient and effective charity rather than working on the ground for that charity in the first place. That in itself appears counterintuitive. And of course, the logical outcome, I suppose, would be that maybe everyone should just get a high-paying job and donate a large amount to an effective charity.
It is somewhat counterintuitive. And I think that's one of the reasons it's a powerful idea. Is it forces us to think a little bit differently about some of the assumptions that we just make. Now, I think that it doesn't generalize to everybody, and I think we're not at risk of everybody going off and getting a high-paying job in order to donate all of it to charity, partly because there's a limit on the number of high-paying jobs that are available. So a lot of these ideas, when you start thinking about the counterfactual, they end up being sort of self-correcting, and as more and more people adopt this way of thinking, you don't just get these runaway absurd scenarios because everyone's reacting to what other people would be doing.
One other criticism, and I suppose it's quite a powerful one really, is that what you're doing is fiddling a little bit at the edges, that in fact if you worked out a system which would change the system that creates the inequalities and the bad lives for people, that in itself, that overthrow or change or refiguring of that bad system would do a lot more than just one-off project. So in other words, you know, a bad government in a particular part of the world, that might be the problem as opposed to the effects of that bad government.
I think this is a really important question, and it's one that I think about a lot when I'm working out what the Center for Effective Altruism should be working on. One of my responses is that things like our project Giving What We Can, which tries to encourage people to set aside a tenth of their income completely voluntarily and to think every year about how to give it to the most effective causes, is really a kind of deep systemic change. Creating that kind of mindset in a large part of the population would, I think, be a complete game changer in how we think about the world, how we interact, how people participate in the political economy. I really do think of this as a form of systemic change. But beyond that, I think there's a risk to trying to reform political systems, which is that we're very bad, historically, at working out what's actually wrong with political systems. So a huge, huge, important part of effective altruism is being quite robustly confident about the things that you do recommend as good. And I'm fairly confident that I know, you know, within 20% either way, what distributing malaria nets in the developing world gets us. honestly, I have no idea what the effect of advocating certain types of political change in different countries is going to be. The systems are hugely chaotic, they're hugely complicated, and I think it would be overconfident of us to be advocating for any specific thing.
So it's not revolutionary in that sense with a big R.
I think history has taught us that going out there with huge ideas that don't react to the situation on the ground and don't react to the complexity of the real world is doomed to failure. And that's not something that I would advocate or I think we should try. I think the more sensible approach and the one that will bring us bigger changes in the long run is getting everybody just thinking a little bit more carefully about who they're trying to help, because I think most people do want to make the world a better place, and how they're going about offering that help.
The greatest happiness of the greatest number, prescribed Jeremy Bentham in his utilitarian creed. He might have added, through the proven best method. Sebastian Farquhar is Executive Director of the Centre for Effective Altruism on a very practical Philosopher's Zone. So what works? What do we know works at this point?
So this is a fantastic question, and it's an area that's been developing very rapidly, and our state of knowledge is improving very rapidly. At the moment, the best advice for individual donors comes from GiveWell, which is an organization that was set up in the late 2000s to evaluate charities on their underlying effectiveness of their programs and on how well they deliver them. And at the moment, the most effective programs that they've uncovered are in global health and global poverty reduction. And they include the Against Malaria Foundation, which is an extremely cost-effective charity that delivers bed nets, insecticide-treated bed nets that help prevent malaria in large parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And these bed nets are very cheap to distribute, used quite widely, and they have a evidence-based, proven success rate based on high-quality randomized controlled trials. And distributing them costs about $5,000 Australian to save one life, which is a really remarkable number, because that's the sort of money which an ordinary Australian family could donate if they were giving, say, a tenth of their income as members of Giving What We Can in Australia do, while still remaining in the sort of top 10% of the world's population by income, just because of the striking distributions of income in the world. Other really effective programs include distributing deworming tablets for neglected tropical diseases. These are conditions that can cause long-term disability or just malnutrition, which can severely damage a child's learning outcomes and life success, and can be treated for as little as 50 cents per child per year. There's a really exciting program called Give Directly, which very simply uses mobile banking to distribute the money that donors give in the developed world to individuals who are quite badly off, who can then spend the money however they like on whatever is most important to them. And what's been found in randomized controlled trials is that this is a very effective way of improving their quality of life, and that most individuals spend it on things like tinned roofs for their houses, which save them a huge amount of money in the long run, but are often not the sorts of things that development experts would have come up with. So that's a program I'm really excited about.
Interesting. The example about deworming, there is obviously debate over that versus, say, more textbooks and school books for children at school as a way of getting better educational outcomes. But what you're saying is that, in fact, something like deworming might actually do the job in the way that more textbooks may not.
Right. So we actually did some analysis because we were quite concerned that we were focusing too much on health and not enough on things like education. But we ended up finding that deworming appears to be one of the most cost-effective interventions on education outcomes alone, even if you ignore the health effects, just because sick children can't go to school. And so you increase school attendance and educational outcomes hugely just by making sure that young children don't have these parasitic conditions.
It's fascinating work and very interesting in the way that it's been thought through. It meets very much the modern world's need for precision and getting to the absolute nub and to the corners of everything. Are you worried sometimes that it is just a little bit too precise in that way, that maybe you could get things wrong in the way that you've said that challenging entire systems may not be a good idea?
I think it's important to think about what precision in the sorts of calculations that we're talking about here is for. Nobody I know who thinks about these numbers on a regular basis thinks that they're sort of literally correct. We know that they're off by probably an order of magnitude in any direction. They're just estimates. They're very rough estimates, is that. And they're based on models with huge amounts of uncertainty. But one of the powerful things that we've realized is that even considering this huge uncertainty, the difference that we're talking about in the world is just enormous. We're talking many orders of magnitude. So let me give you an example. It costs roughly $50,000 to train a seeing eye dog in the developed world and then bring it to the developing world in order to provide assistance to blind people in the developing world. On the other hand, you have programs which for $20 can provide a safe, effective surgery that cures someone of blindness caused by cataracts. So we're talking something like a 10,000 times difference in the number of people that you can even help between these two interventions. And in one case, of course, you're actually curing the blindness, and in the other, you're just facilitating the life of the individual who remains blind. Now, I think both of these programs are very worthwhile, but what this shows is that being off by, you know, a factor of 10 on either of those estimates just isn't going to matter to the overall point. And this is something that we observe again and again. So even though we expect to be wrong on some of the particulars, we expect the broader story to move us in the direction of being able to help more people more effectively.
Do you think it'll take off? It has taken off as an idea?
I think it's taken off quite well so far. We wrote down the name something like 3 years ago. Since then, it has grown by leaps and bounds. This summer, we had more than 1,000 people go to conferences that we ran all over the world to hear about effective altruism and to hear speakers talk about their plans or their experiences with effective altruism. Speakers like Elon Musk from Tesla, or Dan Ariely, the behavioral psychologist who wrote Predictably Irrational, or a number of development experts or people running the charities that we're talking about here. And I think this is just a sign of the direction that the general idea is going. I feel that effective altruism resonates deeply with a modern idea, a modern desire to do good, but which is informed by our desire for evidence, our desire for seeing effectiveness. And this is something that's really enabled by the technological trends. It used to be that you just needed to sort of trust a charity when they said they were going to go to the developing world and do good with it. Now with mobile phones, we can, you know, get people in the field to take a photo of the toilet that they've installed to make sure that it's been installed correctly, that it's actually been installed, and that it's where we thought it was going to be. This revolution in transparency empowers people all over the world, like your listeners, to take an active role in charitable work all over the world and to do it with a sense of confidence that they're actually getting something done. And I think that that's a really powerful, a really exciting concept, which is changing a lot of people's minds and getting a lot of people to do things that they wouldn't have done before when they might have been more skeptical.
Well, I imagine that this has been quite a career step for you and one that you're quite happy with. I imagine you're not going to hang up your boots and go back to physics or theoretical philosophy too early.
Honestly, I love philosophy and I miss it. And it pulls at my heart on a regular basis. But no, it's a very interesting problem. And I think it's one which has far more practical application than the sorts of things that I would have been thinking about if I'd continued to work on philosophy.
A graduate in both physics and philosophy, Sebastian Farquhar, these days Executive Director of the Centre for Effective Altruism, where numbers count. Today's Calculated Good Intentions were brought to you by Diane Dean and Andrei Shabanov. Next week, the start of the summer season here in the Philosopher's Zone, and we begin with that fascinating story of the physicist and the philosopher, Albert Einstein and Henri Bergson, and their battle over the true nature of time. I'm Joe Gelonesi. Hope to see you then.